Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. A ban to prevent the homeless from taking over bus stops is now in place on Kauai. Honolulu is following the Garden Isles lead, with the mayor signing a bill into law that takes effect this summer. It's something that's being closely watched by the American Civil Liberties Union. We sit down with its legal director, Mateo Caballero.
Two organizations that serve street youth, Waikiki Health and Hale Kipa, collaborating with the UH Center on the Family, have released the first comprehensive research study since the 80s of the lives of homeless and runaway youth. And Lonnie Bunch, founding director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, reflects on the nation's history and its future.
It's Monday, February 26th. The conversation starts right after the news. They were built as bus stops, but bus riders have long complained about the homeless turning those shelters into their bedrooms or, worse, bathrooms. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell signed a bill to try and do something about it. The law kicks in this summer, but Kauai took the lead in making it illegal to lie down at or near bus stops between certain times. The ACLU worries the move will expand to include libraries and schools.
So, you know, it is not about one law specifically. It's not about even the text of this law or access to bus stops that we're concerned. We're really concerned about the larger context, which is that for the past 3 or so years, we have essentially passed a bunch of laws that criminalize everyday activity, things that you and me do on a daily basis. And all of these laws have been passed targeting, people that essentially just happen to have no homes. The ACLU's position is that these people deserve and have constitutional rights, and we're there to protect them regardless of whether they have a permanent place to sleep at night or not. And so our main concern is that it just adds to that web of laws that essentially are used on a day-to-day basis to just criminalize homelessness here in Honolulu.
Now, you folks did file a complaint in court over the sit-lie bill.
Yes, we did, and it was about how it was being enforced. So the court case, which we filed a couple of years back, and we settled with the city, essentially was because the police and the crews that were sent to the sweeps of the city streets were not conducting them in accordance with the law. They were just taking people's property away, things like their documents, medicine, toys, the only belongings that the people had, and then instead of keeping them in storage that they were supposed to for a period of time, they were just disposing of them without any due process of law. So we filed a lawsuit and we settled, and we essentially settled for the city having just to follow the law, essentially keep, giving people notice before they conduct the sweeps, and giving people an opportunity to take the belongings away as opposed to just throwing them out. And then once, if the person for any reason cannot take the belongings away, the city is supposed to store them for a period of time and give the person an opportunity to retrieve them without necessarily having to pay anything.
Right, and I know the state has also been looking to see how that progressed, because they have their issues on their own properties under the freeway viaducts. And, that kind of a thing on under the bridges, in the harbors.
Yes. And as far as we know, the state has also been following similar protocols where they go and they give notice and they give up the persons there an opportunity to retrieve their property. Or if they can't, at least give them an opportunity later to retrieve it from a storage. And again, from our perspective, that's the minimum that due process requires.
Okay. So in the case of this a recent legislation that the mayor signed last week, and then also Kauai, which went into effect last week as well, it also prohibits, lying down in an area around the bus stops during certain hours. So you see it along those same lines?
Well, again, we see it in the larger context of, for the past three or so years, we have had a number of bills that essentially are targeting a very specific group of people. And whenever you're targeting a specific group of people, there are concerns. Like, for example, one is selective enforcement. Let's say the new ban on lying on benches around bus stops or lying within 20 feet of bus stops. My guess is that that will only be enforced against people that do not have homes, as opposed to, for example, a tourist in Waikiki that is taking a nap.
There are concerns, though, from bus riders about this growing problem where the homeless are setting up camps and taking over the area and using them as their bedrooms or bathrooms, and then it just becomes just a public health hazard. And then when the city comes in, they take out the benches, and then there's no place for the elderly to sit. So how do you explain your position to those people who just want to wait for the bus and want to be able to sit down?
Yeah, well, look, we all live in the same city. We want a clean, safe city. And access to bus stops is actually important to the ACLU for a number of reasons, including people with disabilities often need to have access to sidewalks and to the bus stops. And so it's not a question to us about the specifics of the law, of this law. But it is about, again, how is going to be enforced. Is it going to be enforced against everyone or just a very specific group of people? And are we given ultimately an opportunity to people to follow the law? One of the reasons the people without homes have been driven to bus stops and to seek shelter in kind of these nooks and crannies of the city is because of the other Sidlai laws that the city has passed. Essentially, we're driving them away from an area to another without actually giving them any way to comply with the law, meaning shelter, meaning bathrooms, meaning places where they can be without necessarily, you know, being driven away by the police on the daily sweeps. So our concern, again, is that it's not necessarily the law itself, but is that it is part of a larger network of laws that target homeless and make it pretty much impossible for them to follow the law because there are essentially no sufficient shelters in the city to house all the homeless people here.
So you folks did submit testimony opposing this here in Honolulu. What happens going forward? Do you think there might be legal challenges down the road?
Well, you know, for us, legal challenges are always the last resort. And we hope we can talk to the city and find ways in which they can enforce the law that is in a constitutional manner. I know the city is also making efforts to increase the housing available for the homeless and the shelter available for the homeless. And we support those efforts. They are important efforts. That being said, you know, given the path in which we're going, it is possible that there will be a legal challenge in the future.
What about on Kauai?
Well, on Kauai, I'll admit, I'm not as familiar with the situation there. My sense is that other counties, they do not enforce the laws on a daily basis. And there are still areas where, for example, people that do not have homes can go. And in Honolulu, in the city and county, what you have is, as we expand those areas, you know, at first it was commercial areas. But now with the Sidlai ban expanding to bus stops and perhaps even there is a proposal to expand it to schools and public libraries, then we're talking about very, very large swaths of the island where essentially then people that do not have homes would have to, you know, leave the city and county of Honolulu if they want to comply with the law. And I think at that point, you know, the constitutional concerns are very serious.
And do you feel, though, that these laws then aren't working in Honolulu?
They are not working. I mean, we have data. And, you know, I was looking at the point in time count for last year. You know, we conducted the one for this year recently, so the numbers are not out yet. But the ones for last year. And what you see is that we have increased for the past 3 years the number of unsheltered individuals in Honolulu. In fact, even though the economy is doing great, even though in other islands the unsheltered individuals, unsheltered homeless people have reduced, here in Honolulu, you have an increase from roughly 1,600 people at night to 2,300. So that's a large increase. I think one of the reasons is that this isn't working. We're spending a lot of resources, a lot of money, but we aren't really providing homeless individuals an option to go to sleep at night, a viable option.
Mateo Caballero is ACLU's legal director. The group works to defend and advance the civil rights and liberties of everyone in Hawaii, but particularly those of prisoners, immigrants, LGBTQ individuals, the homeless, disabled, and other disadvantaged minorities.
This week's On the Media, survivors of Florida's Parkland shooting are making heartfelt pleas for gun reform. The response from the conspiracy wackos? They're child actors.
By Tuesday, the conspiracy went viral on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., liked two tweets.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, new data on the lives of homeless and runaway youth. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're getting out our well-worn copy of Hawaii's Birds, a publication of the Hawaii Audubon Society, to identify a bird that's considered one of the most beautiful songbirds in the islands. It was introduced to Kauai from Malaysia in 1931 and released on Oahu the following year. Both sexes are about the same size, from 9 to 11 inches in length. And males are a glossy black color with a chestnut-colored belly. Females are a dull gray. Both sexes are popular as caged birds, and some of their population on Oahu and Kauai comes from escapees. Their song is a big part of their appeal as household pets, and we'll play you a recorded sample in just a second. Birders say if you can whistle their call, they might just follow you around, but sudden noises can easily scare them away. Today, we're looking for their English name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Eunice Sim from Hawaii Baptist Academy, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Waikiki Health's Youth's Outreach Program, known as YO, has been gathering empirical evidence for years about the lives of homeless and runaway youth in Hawaii. But now it has more to go on. It has the numbers. The statistics gathered in the first study of its kind since the 80s tell us much about cycles of abuse and addiction and about the everyday lives of unaccompanied homeless youth. Kent Anderson is Waikiki Health's Chief High-Risk Services Officer and oversees Waikiki Health's Youth Outreach, PATH Clinic, and HIV programs. We spoke with him about the study.
The numbers of the study really tell us a lot. Some of it's verifying things we knew, and some of it's telling us things that, hey, we hadn't really thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the biggest things that this report quantifies is, as we've been trying to say, our kids on the streets who are homeless, generally they're the victims of abuse, whether mm-hmm. it be physical, sexual, emotional, a lot on the physical and the sexual side. So this report showed that over 75% of the kids actually are the victims of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And truthfully, if you get to understand the psychology of someone who's been abused, oftentimes they're not even willing to admit to it. So there are certain things in this report that we're pretty confident are underreported.
There could even be a greater number. But
we assume this one's actually higher. Mm-hmm. But one thing that we are intentional to do is to not guide the respondents and to not, even if we knew an answer was wrong, mm-hmm. if we've had personal experience with this youth that, hey, we know something's happening in this area, we purposely just recorded the answers of the youth so that there would be no bias and that there would be no mm-hmm. incorrect data, basically trying to keep the integrity of the research. So the abuse is definitely one thing that really jumped out from the data. Another thing that jumped out from the data is these kids are coming from really unstable backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Over half of the kids' parents had substance abuse issues of their own. Over half of the kids' parents were incarcerated. About 40% of the kids had an interaction with the foster care community. And what that shows is that these kids, there's this connection between family instability and life on the streets, and that if we can't provide, as a community, better family stability, we're going to continue to have more and more kids on the streets.
There's a social fabric that has existed for generations that's torn here.
Very much so. And truthfully, I don't know if families in crisis are getting the level of support. Well, the data would suggest they're not getting the level of support that they would benefit from to try to help prevent intergenerational types of homelessness or cycles of issues and cycles of problems.
Mm-hmm. Certainly with abuse, we've seen cyclical recurrence if the abused child becomes an abuser.
Yes.
Frequently, one of the figures that really jumped out at me was the number of these homeless kids on the street who themselves want to have children. What do you think's behind that?
So the research showed that about 30% of the kids currently have had a child. And actually, national research has said that 50% of street youth have had a pregnancy experience.
We're talking about teenagers.
Yes, we're talking, well, generally 14 to 22 is usually mm-hmm. the age range that they're looking mm-hmm. at. But the majority of that, or at least a large percentage of that, would be teenagers.
Pretty young kids. Yeah.
Yes. And those numbers actually match pretty well, because if you look at that national 50%, that would include actual pregnancies, that would include miscarriages, that would include abortions.
Mm-hmm.
So this, in our local study, 30% actually had the child. That's a huge number of kids. And there's many reasons for it. One of the biggest reasons that we've seen is a lot of these youth, they're just longing for a healthy relationship. They have been the victims of abuse. They've struggled with so much family strife, and that's not just direct family, that's extended family.
Mm-hmm.
And in their community, they don't feel loved and they don't feel welcomed. So for some, they see a baby as this chance to have this loving, close relationship that can really fill that void in their heart. For other youth, particularly some of the young women, they definitely see this opportunity to, in their mind, hook on to a guy. They think, hey, if I get pregnant, I'll have him forever and we can get married.
You'll have a family life stabilized.
A stable family life of our own. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. as we know, generally, especially with younger kids, if a young woman gets pregnant, it's more likely that the man runs away in these situations than mm-hmm. the man actually sticks around. So we actually work intensively with these youth to try to help educate them that that is not the reality and that that's not a solution. And then you have other issues to where, for example, young women will trade their bodies, and young men, honestly, it's both. Mm-hmm. Young men and women will trade their bodies for things they need to survive, places to sleep, things like that. And that can definitely lead to pregnancy experiences as well. One of the things I'm proud to say that we've been trying to do at Waikiki Health is we've been really trying to put a lot of effort into pregnancy prevention programs and really trying to break the cycle, because I think we all agree kids on the streets should not be having kids. And if we don't directly intervene, we are not. What's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting
that
different results, basically. So we're trying to do some different things. And the great news for us is we've been getting great results on pregnancy prevention with this new federal project that we've been working on. And one thing that's not known is a lot of these kids that we've been building these relationships on the pregnancy prevention side, we're actually helping them get housed. More than half of the kids we've served so far, we've gotten off the streets and get housed as we're simultaneously helping them prevent unwanted pregnancies.
There's so many fronts on which you have to move simultaneously to give these kids a better life. And one thing I have to wonder about, Kent, is, you know, the desire to have a child to fill a void in the heart, as mm-hmm. that you described. And yet at the same time, they're bringing kids into a world that's, for them, is not much of a world. And I wonder if that, you know, what they think about that, you know. Do they want to bring kids into the world that they experience day to day? Obviously, the desire to have a kid trumps that, but...
That's a very deep, complicated question, to be blunt, and it differs for each youth. But
sure.
I will tell you, from our experience, that's one of the reasons we really believe that you need to have intensive intervention with relationship building. A lot of the work mm-hmm. that we do at Youth Outreach is really trying to create these deep, lasting, trusting relationships with the youth. And through that aspect, try to remind them, hey, there is a better future ahead. There are opportunities. You can still dream. There's things to reach for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just trying to survive from a day-to-day basis, which a lot of these kids are in daily survival mentality. By building those trusting relationships and layering in, as the trust is developed, education, options, opportunities, linkage to resources, many of these kids, they realize, hey, I do want something different for my future. And yes, I might want to have a child, but I don't necessarily want to have that child now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing that people might forget is these kids on the streets care just as much about themselves and their potential children as anyone else would. They're just dealing with a whole world of strife and struggles to where sometimes they're so focused on just today.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what our intensive work does, is it helps our youth focus on their longer term goals as we get them housed, we get them stable, and we get them set up for success.
Are they a forgotten population?
This youth, street youth homelessness has been a very much forgotten generation or forgotten group. It's kind of interesting. They even have terms like throwaway youth. Just by even having the term throwaway youth,
kidding, yeah.
That is pretty much saying by definition that these are people who are just being thrown away, for example. The good news is there is starting to be some more attention. There's actually even starting to be some more resources that are starting to be dedicated to this population. But I can tell you, like about a decade ago, I was actually the chair of Partners in Care, which is the continuum of all homeless providers.
Right.
I can tell you from that level, knowing, having a pretty good beat on the pulse, just 10 years ago, this population wasn't really being talked about much. There was Youth Outreach was talking about it, but they mm-hmm. didn't really have a very loud voice at the table, in all sincerity. I would say over the last two, 3 years, there's starting to be more attention, and federally, as you probably know, there was really attention on addressing veteran homelessness, and then there's intention on family homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, and we've made real progress in those areas. And currently, there's more and more attention starting to be given to unaccompanied youth and domestic violence. And one of the great things that have happened, and just happened a few months ago, is for the first time last year, there were some federal resources that went directly to housing vouchers for unaccompanied youth, youth on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of skepticism. Will this work? Will this not work? Will these kids actually go into housing? In the last, I don't know, about 4 months, there's been about 20 kids who've gotten off the streets, and actually I think it's more than 20 kids, who have gotten into housing using these housing vouchers. And in a few months, there's going to be more of those vouchers coming on board here in Hawaii. So we're thrilled that these resources are starting to come into place and that we're starting to get data, because that was one of the challenges historically. There just wasn't a whole lot of validated data
mm-hmm.
that people could look at to say, oh, this really is an issue.
Are you finding reasons for optimism?
I think there's always reasons for optimism. I think there's a lot of work ahead of us, but the fact that, as I said, over 20 kids have gotten off the streets into housing of their own, and that doesn't even take into consideration the fact that we're constantly working at family reunification. We're constantly looking at, hey, maybe there's somebody else in the community or even foster care system. There are multiple areas that you can actually get kids off the street. To me, that's the goal, is getting the kids off the street, because the streets are not a healthy place to be. There's more than that, but that's the first goal, is getting them off the streets and setting them up with support and love and nourishing emotional support as well as physical support. Because I don't want us to kid ourselves. Just getting somebody off the street and plopping them in housing, that does not consistently work. Even the housing first models, we talk about the housing, but people forget there's this wraparound support, because a lot of these kids, they're young, and they haven't been taught some of the basic tools that most of us were taught on just how to live on their own. and they were thrown in a world where they had to survive on their own before they were ready, and they've adapted and they've learned things to get that daily survival mode, but it prevents some of their long-term goals. Case in point, let's say you've never trusted an adult in your life because you've been abused. How are you really going to be a good employee if you just refuse, if you have a hard time trusting and listening to what your boss tells you to do? So it takes this retraining, this relearning, this support to try to really help maximize their potential and set them up for long-term success.
Kent Anderson is Waikiki Health's Chief High-Risk Services Officer and oversees Waikiki Health's Youth Outreach, PATH Clinic, and HIV programs. You can find the link to the full report on our Facebook page.
Eat the Sun is a San Francisco experimental string trio with guitar, bass, and koto. Listen to them live as they listen to HPR's near acoustically perfect Atherton Studio, Sunday, March 4th at 4 p.m. Reserve your seats to Eat the Sun by calling 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Older neighborhoods on Oahu are feeling the pressure of more cars parked on the street. It's a problem on narrow, substandard streets, so it's no wonder there's pushback with monster homes and vacation rentals when cars can barely squeeze through. That's the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Reporter Marcel Henri joins us. Morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be here.
So tell us, what are you experiencing there in Kaimuki?
Yeah, you know, this is something that affects Kaimuki, but I'm sure a lot of listeners right now are saying, hey, I know streets in my neighborhood. It's something that affects streets all over Oahu, and it's just these older, narrower streets, particularly with street parking, where it can just be such a grind to navigate and get through the neighborhood.
I know in some areas, too, there is a dispute over who owns the roads, and as a consequence, you've got no sidewalks in some cases, but even when you do have sidewalks, there's really not enough room to maneuver when the streets are so narrow.
Yeah, a big issue is the street parking, where you have no sidewalks in some of those neighborhoods. You'll see cars are able to kind of park up on the properties and off to the side. On some of these other public roads, in the older neighborhoods, that the houses were constructed with one car garages or just parking that was severely limited, so that street parking is really valuable, and it just kind of creates this dilemma of what to do with the narrow spaces.
And I thought it was interesting in your story that you talked about how there's some discussion about do you make it a one-way street in order to keep the traffic through those areas.
Yeah, and it turns out there is a process that the city will look at. It really has to be, in most cases, a grassroots-led effort. The residents have to come to the city and say, look, we're fed up with this, and we'd like to look for a change. But the city has to look at different issues and whether that's feasible. They have to look at whether there are if somebody on one street is frustrated and wants to turn it into a one-way, you need to have at least another street that can complement it with one-way direction going in the opposite direction. There are other issues like trash collection, where we have these trash collecting trucks, right, that have these lifts, these mechanical lifts, but they're only facing in one way. So you have to be able to provide for manual trash collection where the workers can, traditionally where they would be off hanging off the back of the truck and depositing the trash that way. So there are all these other issues that you have to take into consideration before you just pull the trigger and make a street one way.
Right. I mean, it's risky business. I know I've covered stories in Nuuanu where not even the ambulance could get through. And I think in that case, the EMS folks recommended to the city that they actually ban parking on one side of the street just so they could get through. I think it was even hard for the mail carrier. So health and safety is a big deal.
It's a factor. I checked in with Honolulu Fire on this. They're fairly confident that they can access all the areas that they need to get to with at least some or most of their equipment. One spokesperson that I had talked to with HFD talked about their veteran firefighters who know a lot of the tricks of the trade. They know where the different utility poles are hanging down into the roadway, or there's a tree that makes it tough. So they actually rely on a lot of their institutional knowledge to get around town.
All right. Well, don't get hit out there. Be careful.
You too. Thanks, Catherine.
All right. And that was Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check.
This past Friday on The Conversation, we hosted a roundtable discussion of school shootings with local stakeholders. We heard ideas from students, teachers, parents, and advocates on both sides of the issue. Here's what a few listeners who didn't make it on the air had to say.
My name is Catherine. I am a health professional who has worked mental health and rehabilitation. I've seen many more suicides and homicides and attempted with guns. And I have to challenge the premise that if there is an armed teacher or guard, there will not be an attempt at a shooting. A lot of these guys are, they want to do death by cop. They want to do death by gun. And what better way to do it than to know that that's waiting for them there? Mahalo.
This is Nathan calling from Ever Beach. I'd like to suggest that maybe if we just lowered the caliber of the weapons to something that was less deadly and more used in hunting would solve a lot of the issues.
My name is Janice. I'm from Kona. The conversation about gun lobbyists should be broadened to include all campaign financing that comes from special interest groups and corporations. Trying to single out the gun lobby will be a dead end as far as campaign finance and lobbying goes. But if we can take the broader issue of campaign finance control, we'll be way better off. Mahalo.
My name is Randy Gantz. I'm calling from Kaneohe. I'm a military veteran. I'm a combat veteran. I've deployed multiple times overseas in the current wars. And I was just appalled at hearing some of the comments from the former law enforcement officer about things that he was suggesting that would actually make us much, much more unsafe. And, you know, I've seen people that have thousands and thousands of hours at the gun range, who have combat training, who have spent their entire military careers training for these types of situations, live fire missions, you name it, and then when the bullets actually start to fly and they're in a situation facing an enemy or a combatant, they lock up, they start shaking uncontrollably, and in some instances when they do actually get some rounds off, that they're so unsteady because their body is in such a state of shock that those bullets are flying in many different directions. And furthermore, we have to remember that bullets go through objects very easily. I mean, they're designed to go through objects. A standard round of a gun that has been used in some of these school shootings will go through three or four walls in a building. You can actually hit your target, hit a person, and it can tear through their body and hit someone behind them. So can you imagine arming school teachers or arming anyone, or just saying that everyone needs to carry guns, and then when situations happen, everyone's taking out weapons and trying to shoot a fleeing suspect? I mean, there's going to be so many more unnecessary deaths. The answer is not arming more people or training people how to use weapons and defend themselves. You look at statistics, too, specifically in New York, they released a statement saying that law enforcement officers have about an 18% hit rate when they actually discharge their weapon. So these officers are trained, and New York has a lot more crime and violent crime than we do in Hawaii, and they can only hit them 18%. Do we want to live in a society where everywhere we go there's armed guards? Do we want to live in a police state where everyone is armed everywhere we go because we're just afraid? Thank you for your time. Mahalo.
And thank you for your thoughts. If you ever want to comment on something you heard on this program, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Drew from Paradise Cove. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. We're tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, as usual, and welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, how are you? What do you have for us this week?
Hello, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, you'll have to be up late to see Mars and Jupiter as both rise after midnight. The moon this week will be passing through its full moon phase, so stargazing for those faint objects is going to be rather tricky.
And this week, I understand that you've got to return to a topic we have discussed before, which is probably a pretty life or death one eventually, and that is what people wear when they go out into the treacherous reaches of space.
Absolutely. If you have been paying attention to the Olympics over the past couple of weeks, you would have seen many athletes wearing what are called skin suits. These are specially designed pieces of clothing that enhance an athlete's natural aerodynamic properties, enabling them to ski faster, jump farther, essentially reducing their air resistance.
And I'm imagining that this is a vehicle where you can showcase really modern technology when it comes to materials they're using for clothes.
And these materials sometimes find their way into space. In fact, a new type of skin suit has been designed and tested with astronauts in mind.
So I imagine the astronauts aren't going to be competing in some way, so how will this material help them?
Well, these newly developed skin suits will stop the astronauts from experiencing chronic pain due to their spines extending in space.
It's a phenomenon of space, huh, that when you go up there, you temporarily get a little bigger.
You get a little taller and a little ganglier, too. In orbit, the human body is not under the compressive force of gravity that a planet provides, and so extended periods in space can lead to the human body, its limbs and the spine and other things becoming extended.
And that cannot be good for your health.
Over long periods of time, no, and especially considering that also in space, your muscles and bones degrade over time.
Right. There's all these little threats up there. Not a place I want to be working, that's for sure. And I'm getting the feeling that this kind of gear, while it may be beneficial for you to wear, may not be the most comfortable.
It certainly isn't right now. In fact, they're still testing it, and it can only be used for a few hours at a time. So they've still got a ways to go before an astronaut can wear this for essentially a whole day in space.
Well, that's something they're going to have to obviously continue to work on. And we know we'll hear updates on it from time to time right here with you. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much for this week's report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, a new online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about Cocycus balabaricus, a songbird that was introduced to the islands in the middle of the last century. It has a glossy blue-black head, nape, back, and upper breast with a distinctive red-brown belly and lower breast. It thrives on dense underbrush where it feeds on insects. In captivity, they can be fed on a diet of boiled, dried legumes with egg yolk and raw meat. Their song is the key to their popularity, and one of the first audio recordings ever made of a bird song was made from this species. It was made on an Edison wax cylinder in 1889 by one Ludwig Koch. If you're on a hike on Oahu or Kauai, try whistling their song, and a shama thrush, sometimes known as a white-rumped shama, might just answer.
And Ron Kodama of Mililani got it right. A great quiz. Lots of phone lines were ringing from all over the state, including Kauai and Molokai. People just love the shama. In fact, one Macnut farmer shared that he's partial to shamas because they actually tried to build a nest in his boot. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Growing up in Newark in the 1950s, Lonnie G. Bunch III didn't find too many books to read about black heroes and wondered why that was. His curiosity put him on the path to his future. He's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, and we talked earlier this morning about the ways history helps us understand our lives.
Well, for me, it was first going to the library and reading every historical biography of George Washington and the guy that invented the sewing machine and Clara Barton. And in one day, I realized there was nobody black in those books.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I'd like to know a little bit about people that look like me. Suddenly, I found a biography of Frederick Douglass. And I remember thinking, this is amazing. I'm not Frederick Douglass, but I can understand the sense of need for belonging, a sense of being something important. And so for me, history became a way, candidly, for me to understand my life. Because I grew up in an Italian town, very few black people. And I suddenly said, if I could understand a little bit more about history, maybe I'll understand why some people treat me wonderfully and others treat me horribly.
Which is, that's quite a trick, understanding that, because it's gone through so many layers of, you know, misunderstanding, whatever you want to call it, right?
And because I couldn't figure out, I thought maybe history might be the only way I could figure that out.
And then as you make that exploration of history, you find out that there are an awful lot of black heroes that nobody's bothered to write about.
And an awful lot of black heroes and white heroes who cross racial lines mm-hmm. to make America better. So for me, it was looking at those people who were brave enough to say, we want to demand America live up to its stated ideals.
Now, that's interesting that you bring that up, because white America is not crazy about bringing around the history of white Americans who cross those lines.
I think that's right. I think in many ways, the real challenge is for Americans to embrace a more complicated, nuanced history of some of the people who deserve to be remembered, but also some of the people who deserve to be called out.
Isn't that always the case, though, with history? You know?
Absolutely. I think that in some ways, the challenge is, how do we overcome the creation myths and really wrestle with the sort of complexity and nuance of history?
Well, you know, it of course bears repeating that history is written by the victors. The reason it's written by the victors is what I'm interested in. And what do you think those reasons are?
Well, I think, first of all, part of it is that it's very easy to shape national identity around heroic moments, heroic stories. So for the victors who have a military experience or a political experience, it's easy to then say, this is why the country is great, because of people like us. And I think the challenge is to say, a country can be great even if it's not victorious, even if it's not always on the right side of history. That's the real challenge, is how people embrace the fact that this is a much more complicated history than we'd like to have.
I don't think you're going to find too many nations that don't have something to be ashamed of.
Oh, I think that's right. I think that, for me, one of the most important things about museums around the world is that museums are really things that shape national identity. Sometimes they're created by the state to create maybe a false national identity. Mm-hmm. But my argument is that places like the Smithsonian, places like the Bishop Museum and others should be places that help people grapple with complexity and understand their identities in a way that isn't just driven by myths.
Now, that wasn't always the way museums were run. You didn't talk about lynchings. You didn't talk about the Holocaust in a museum.
Well, I think that my career has really paralleled the changes in museums, mm-hmm. right? Because I felt very strongly that a museum's, when I started, was all about celebration. It was all about how wonderful we were, whatever the we is. Mm-hmm. But now the notion is, how do we commemorate? How do we grapple with complexity? I think the best museums are museums that help people embrace ambiguity, rather than simply give simple answers to complex questions. Help people grapple with the gray and the sides that aren't as clear. That, I think, is really what a good museum can do.
You know, you and I were talking about the books that we read as kids, and the trouble with, I was remembering the Landmark book series that Doubleday put out, in which every episode in American history was a heroic one with white stars, from the Alamo to, you know, whatever, the Battle of Yorktown. And then in later life, I've had to relearn all those stories. And when you're told a story that's dressed up and airbrushed, and then you find out there's a lot of falsehood in it, or that, you know, the ugly episodes have been airbrushed out, it breeds a kind of a distrust in everything you've been toll, doesn't it?
Well, it really means that you've got to find real history rather than simply historical memory, mm-hmm. right? So I think the challenge is not to simply say everybody who was once good was bad, but rather to say if we can add more depth, more richness, if we can add the people who have been left out of history, we're all made better by that process.
Trouble with American history, and we've heard, you know, calls to make America great again, maybe wondering when we stopped. But at the same time, the greatness of America that an American might acknowledge has to be understood in terms of, you know, the oppression of Native Americans, slavery, lynchings, an awfully ugly history. How do you tread that balance and still present America as a great nation at the Smithsonian?
I mean, I think that you do have to find that tension. That's the word you want to find, the tension between moments of greatness and moments of sadness. And I would argue that the American public is ready to understand a little more about its history. I've always argued that the best way to understand America is a work in progress. Right, that there are these moments that America didn't live up to its ideals. These are moments where Native people, there's genocide, where African Americans are enslaved and lynched. But on the other hand, it is some of those very same people who suffer so much who believe in an America that didn't believe in them, who find ways to say, let us live up to the stated ideals of the country. And I would argue in many ways that we have been made better by the people who have protested America. For me, protest in some ways may be the highest form of patriotism.
Well, it was founded on protest.
A little revolution every now and then is good.
You know, John Brown's body in the Civil War, right?
I think that it's really important to realize that change comes not without loss, that there's great difficulty to affect change, but that ultimately, as a country in progress, if you can confront your past and recognize you still have ways to go, rather than say you're already there at the promised land, then I think you become a great nation.
What would it take in terms of our understanding of our history for us to get the rest of the way? What would you like to see happen?
I think, first of all, it's really understanding history, right? It's really say, you know, Americans often are ahistorical. And so to really craft places that allow the public to understand complexity around Confederate monuments, for example, so that I'm a firm believer in education. And if you can convey the complexity, the accuracy of history, then there's always a hope for change.
You know, when that Confederate monument issue came up, I thought of the statue, the golden statue of William Tecumseh Sherman right by the Plaza Hotel, mm-hmm. now the Trump Plaza in New York. And I thought, are we going to pretend that Robert E. Lee didn't exist? You know, where would that end? Find me a general who didn't kill people, right?
I think the most important thing is you don't ever want to erase history, mm-hmm. right? But you want to understand, for example, that people like Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy, they lost the war, but they won the peace. And so I think it's very interesting to look at these statues for what they really are, which tell us less about a civil war and more about an uncivil peace.
But the years that followed.
Exactly. So in the 1890s and early 20th century, these statues are ways for people to create myths and counter the struggle for fairness and equality in so many places.
Robert E. Lee's descendants said, fine, take him off the public street, put him in a museum.
I've always felt that, one, you should never take down all statues, but you should contextualize them, whether it's in museums or in parks. I mean, I've been really struck. There's a park in Budapest that basically took all the Soviet-era statues, and now they're contextualized. You understand what they meant, what they said about you at a particular point in your history. I think it's really important to understand what these statues really meant.
Dr. Lonnie G. Bunch III is the founding director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. He will offer the lecture Educating a Nation, the Challenge of Building a National Museum, tomorrow night at 6 p.m. in the University of Hawaii at Manoa Art Auditorium. Thank you. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Here's something for your inner samurai.
Yes, you can learn about the culture of the samurai in an exhibit currently in Honolulu. The Robin Bunton Gallery on Barataria is holding a samurai sword exhibit and workshop. There will be discussions on samurai ideals and demonstrations of a sword and its parts. And this exhibit runs through March 22nd, and RSVP is appreciated. And to do that, just go to the link on our website.
I hope those demonstrations aren't too realistic.
I hope not. No, just be careful no matter what you do.
Tomorrow, the Waikiki Aquarium tackles the topic of marine alien species in Hawaii.
Yes, and did you know that this is Invasive Species Awareness Week?
I did not.
Yeah, me too. The talk is a part one of a two-part seminar with Scott Godwin and Julie Kuo of the DLNR, and back in the late 1990s, efforts were started to find out what marine alien species are in the islands and to use that data to inform the scientific community. This talk is from 3:30 to 4:30, and once again, it's free at the Waikiki Aquarium.
And then on the Big Island tomorrow, you can hear stories of the early days of ranching on Mauna Kea.
That's right. The eastern slopes of Mauna Kea, that rough section of land is called Humu'ula. It's where sheep and cattle were once ranched. Professor Peter Mills of UH Hilo will share anecdotes and information he gathered during his decade of research and field work. This is happening at 7 p.m. in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium, and it's free.
Thank you, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Jason Taglianetti of Applause in a Small Room.
And I'm DJ Mr. Nick of Bridging the Gap.
We've got some great news to share with you. American Roots is coming back to HPR1.
I love how this show explores what it means to be American through our music, from blues to Cajun,
Tejano to jazz,
country to soul.
Starting March 3rd, American Roots replaces Live From Here on Saturday nights from 6 to 8 p.m.
Find out more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We have to go, but up tomorrow we sit down to tackle the ongoing issue of monster homes. Do you live in one or see one in your neighborhood? The issue comes up before the Honolulu City Council for a final vote this week.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Join us tomorrow for more of the Conversation.